Recorded live at the Alice Stevens Center from the University of Alabama at Birmingham, this is Food and Fellowship, a holiday special from WBHM.
We wish you a Merry Christmas, we wish you a Merry Christmas, we wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Good tidings we bring to you and your kin. Good tidings for Christmas and a Happy New Year. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New
This is a carol that's written in 1833, and we're going to do it just a little bit different version of it. It's called God Rest You Merry Gentlemen.
In Bethlehem in jewelry, this blessed babe was born, and laid within a manger upon this blessed morn. The witch's mother Mary nothing did take in scorn. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy. From God our heavenly Father the blessed angel came, and unto certain shepherds brought tidings of the same. How that in Bethlehem was born the Son of God by name. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy. Fear not then, said the angel, let nothing you affright. This day is born a Savior of virtue, power, and might. So frequently to vanquish all the friends of Satan quite. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy. Shepherds at those tidings rejoiced much in mind, and left their flocks of feeding in tempest, storm, and wind, and went to Bethlehem straightway this blessed babe to find. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy. But when to Bethlehem they came, whereat the infant lay, they found him in a manger where oxen feed on hay. His mother Mary kneeling unto the Lord did pray. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy. Now to the Lord sing praises, all you within this place, and with true love and brotherhood each other now embrace. This holy tide of Christmas all others doth efface. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy.
Let's all sing, shall we?
God rest ye merry gentlemen, let nothing you dismay. Remember Christ our Savior was born on Christmas Day, to save us all from Satan's power when we were gone astray. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy.
I'm Bobby Horton with storyteller Dolores Hydock.
Birthday. birthdays were the only holiday my mother cared anything about. The rest of the holidays, she would have happily scratched right off the calendar. Christmas was the worst with all the fuss and the hassle. She was never sentimental about Christmas. She was not one of those people who send out rafts of cheery Christmas newsletters or read articles on how to turn a turkey carcass into a topiary. A live tree in the living room in December just meant needles in the carpet in July, as far as she was concerned. She was never fond of Christmas. But my dad loved Christmas. Every year, first week of December, he would head out into the wilds of the Boy Scout Christmas tree lot. And with his bare hands, he would select a 7-foot Scotch pine, strap it on top of the black and white Impala, drive it home, drag that tree into the living room like it was some kind of wild creature he had killed in the forest. Fed up with those flimsy red and green metal Christmas tree stands that were in no way equal to the task of supporting his trophy trees, one year my dad made his own Christmas tree stand, welded it out of wrought iron. It was about 15 inches in diameter, had 12-inch long spikes and screws sticking into the center to hold the tree straight. It looked like some kind of medieval torture device. And there was a trough at the bottom you were supposed to fill with wet sand to keep the tree from drying out. Wet sand, wrought iron. The thing must have weighed 200 pounds. And while there was never any danger that the tree would fall over, there was some concern the living room floor might give way. My dad liked things sturdy. And he loved Christmas, loved the spirit of it, the celebration of it, the tradition of it, especially the tradition of the tree. But one year, my two sisters, Lisa and Alice, then 14 and 11, approached my dad with the idea that we needed to do something different that year. We needed a different kind of tree. Instead of the plain old live 7-foot Scotch pine, we needed one of those new trees, one of those silver, space age, aluminum trees, the kind of trees that the Jetsons would have. My sisters argued that the tree would bring our household right up into the middle of the 20th century, and it would be economical because since the tree was permanent, we wouldn't have to buy a new tree every year. My traditionalist dad was skeptical, but he lived in a household with four women and knew which battles were not worth fighting. And so, Christmas 1962, our brand new Evergleam Christmas tree sparkled in the living room in the glow of its very own color wheel. And it did make our house seem more modern and up-to-date. It also seemed to improve the reception on the black and white TV. That tree stood there, shimmering silver all season long, and at the end of December, we packed it up in a big cardboard box, stored it in an attic closet to be taken out the following year. But 11 months later, when we opened that box, we discovered that our Evergleam tree no longer gleamed. The silvery shimmer had gone yellowy green. The branches were tarnished and bent at weird angles, and when we set it up, it looked like a stumpy gray flagpole with tinseled shish kebab skewers sticking out of it. And even my sisters admitted there was no way that could be our Christmas tree that year. And so that year, Christmas 1963, my delighted dad went out and got a live 7-foot Scotch pine. That tree was green, gorgeous, fragrant, and temporary. A reminder that the Christmas spirit can't be manufactured or stored. It has to be renewed fresh every year. And if you're lucky enough to be visited by that gracious spirit at all, that spirit of generosity and wonder, comfort, peace, and joy, you can't hold on to it. You can't save it up. All you can do is notice it, be grateful for it, and enjoy it for the little while that it lasts.
this is one of my favorite carols, and it's a very unusual carol. It's a centuries-old English carol. You know, if you think about the Christmas story, you know, Joseph, an old fellow, marries this young, pretty thing, and then, you know, and everything is great, and the wedding was wonderful, the reception was terrific, and then she says, oh, by the way. You know, his reaction was what I would not call a normal male human reaction to that startling news. Something happened to him to, because, you know, back then, you know, a lady could be stoned for something this bad. This was not good. But he reacted quite unnaturally in some people's eyes. And this carol, several centuries ago, was written to try to maybe explain what might have happened to Joseph to accept things as graciously as he did. Now, as people came to this country, they brought this carol with them. And this is the version, this is the way it was done in the Southland in the 19th century. And it's called the Cherry Tree Carol. Was an old man, an old man was he. He married Virgin Mary, the Queen of Galilee. He married Virgin Mary, the Queen of Galilee. Joseph and Mary walked through an orchard good. There were cherries, there were berries as red as any blood. They were cherries, there were berries as red as any blood. Then Mary spoke to Joseph, so meek and so mild. Joseph, gather me from cherries, for I am with child. Joseph, gather me some cherries, for I am with child. Then Joseph grew in anger grew he. Let the father of thy baby gather cherries for thee. Let the father of thy baby gather cherries for thee. Then Jesus spoke a few words spoke he. Let my mother have some cherries, then low down cherry tree. Let my mother have some cherries, bend low down cherry tree. The cherry tree bowed low down to the ground. And Mary gathered cherries while Joseph stood around. And Mary gathered cherries while Joseph stood around. Took Mary all on his right knee. What have I done, Lord? Have mercy on me. What have I done, Lord? Have mercy on me. Then Joseph took Jesus all on his left knee. Pray tell me, little baby, when thy birthday will be. Pray tell me, little baby, when thy birthday will be. The sixth day on a cold night, my birthday will be. When the stars in the elements will tremble with glee. When the stars in the elements will tremble with glee. As Joseph was a-walking, he heard an angel sing. Tonight shall be the birth time Christ, our Savior King. Tonight shall be the birth time of Christ, our Savior King.
This is Dolores Hydock, and you're listening to Food and Fellowship, a holiday special from WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. Coming up, cooking up memories in a holiday kitchen. Recorded live at the Alice Stevens Center from the University of Alabama at Birmingham, this is Food and Fellowship, a holiday special from WBHM. The holidays are a time of tradition for a lot of people. For some folks, it is decorating the tree. For some people, it's setting up the animated yard art in front of the house, the twirling candy canes, the snowman tipping his top hat. For some people, it's the shopping and wrapping the presents. For some people, it's the open house and all the friends and neighbors getting together, laughing and talking and catching up. At our house, it was all about the baking. The women in my family are bakers. My sister Lisa makes Greek wedding cookies that are so melt-in-your-mouth delicious, it makes you want to get married just so she'll make some. My sister Alice makes apple pies that look like the illustration for the nursery rhyme about Simple Simon and the pieman. You know, mounds of golden apples draped in flaky pastry, steam swirling up out of the decorative cutouts on top. My mother was famous for her chocolate cake, her lemon meringue pie, and her millionaire cookies. Me? I use my oven as a storage cabinet. For half-empty boxes of cereal, unopened cellophane sacks of church fundraiser pecans, and when unexpected company shows up, stacks of library books and junk mail that has to be swept off the counter and hidden someplace until everybody goes away. I've tried, really, I have. But my cakes come out dry, my pie crusts are soggy, my millionaire cookies look like they need a federal bailout. I once even attempted to make my Aunt Gloria's famous, foolproof sour cream pound cake for a church potluck supper. But when I arrived at the event with my burnt on the bottom, lopsided on the top offering, the woman staffing the dessert table just looked at it, looked at me, and said, "That's all right, honey. It's not the food, it's the fellowship." So don't ask me why I agreed December a few years ago when my then 85-year-old mother decided she was not up to it that particular year, and so I should do her holiday baking and she would supervise. I never have understood why people bother to bake at holiday time. Aren't the holidays stressful enough already? Isn't the December calendar already crammed full of too many things to do? Isn't the reason there is a bakery department in every major grocery store to keep people like me from thinking we can bake? But Mother wanted to do this, and so we got out the navy blue three-ring binder stuff full of recipes, copied out of cookbooks, scribbled on the backs of envelopes, clipped out of newspapers. We toyed with the idea of trying something new, something we found in a magazine called Chocolate Caramel Nut Surprise. But then I reminded Mother that anyone who embarked on a recipe with the word surprise in the title was just asking for trouble. And so we settled on a longtime family favorite, Mother's always popular poppy seed swirls. Long loaves of sweet yeast dough curled around a poppy seed filling, baked in logs, cut into thick slices, soft like a bread, not crispy like a cookie. A holiday tradition at our house for decades. If it was Christmas time, we were making poppy seed swirls. I arm myself for baking battle. apron on, wooden spoon ready, spatula standing by. I turn on the oven. The gas jets fire off in quick succession like booster rockets. We have liftoff! It does not take long. No, 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 honey, you're pressing too hard. You want to apply a nice even pressure, nice even pressure. Remember, this is a yeast roll. Now, no, no, put some flour, not that much flour, you're going to make it. Oh, honey, give me that! My 85-year-old mother leaps to her feet, her cane forgotten, hooked over the arm of her chair. Her back, just moments earlier, curved in the question mark of old age, explodes into the exclamation point of irritation as she snatches the rolling pin out of my hand. Oh, honey, here's how you do it. She dusts the wooden surface of the rolling pin with a thin film of white flour. Then with her still strong 85-year-old hands, she goes to work, applying just the right amount of pressure. Oh, she knows how to apply pressure. She raised four children. And just like the four of us, that lump of dough yields to her, dares not resist, allows itself to be shaped just the way she wants it. As she works, the skin of her face becomes as smooth as the pillow of dough on the butcher block surface in front of her. There is a light, almost iridescent quality to her face. The pain in her back is forgotten, the arthritis in her knees, all of that gone. It is Christmas time, and we are making poppy seed swirls. The kitchen door opens, and a child runs in, slamming the door shut hard against the cold outside. The child is me. I'm 10 years old, and I'm helping my mother make poppy seed swirls. I've been sent out to the playhouse to get two sticks of butter. The playhouse is a little room attached to the kitchen of my childhood home back in Reading, Pennsylvania. It's really just an uninsulated, enclosed porch where in the summertime I play with my Betsy McCall paper dolls or read the whole long, low shelf full of childcraft books, all 14 volumes in their bright orange covers. In the summertime, the playhouse is pretty hot, but in the wintertime, it gets cold out there. And so when the weather turns bitter, as it did in December in the Pennsylvania of my childhood, that playhouse becomes a room-sized refrigerator, a wonderful place to store the extra butter and eggs and sour cream we'll need for the holiday baking. I run out there, get two sticks of butter, come back into the warm kitchen with its windows sweating from the hard work of keeping out the cold. I put the two sticks of butter down next to where mother is working, resume my place opposite her, half sitting, half kneeling at the kitchen table of my childhood, the one with the blue and white formica top and the curved metal tubes for legs. My mother looks at the two sticks of butter I brought in, decides she needs one stick more, goes out to the playhouse to get it herself, and this time, when that kitchen door opens, it's my young mother who comes inside. She's in her 30s. Her brown hair is pulled back with little clips on either side. Her face is flushed from the warmth of her work and the preheating oven. She's wearing a gingham apron over her house dress, always a dress. She never once wore slacks until the day of her 80th birthday. She unwraps the butter, goes back to work, and from my place opposite her, I look at the index card that holds the recipe we're working from, the recipe for poppy seed swirls that came from my Aunt Florence. And as I look at that upside-down index card with its pale brown circle of a coffee cup stain, the kitchen door opens, and Aunt Florence comes in. Aunt Florence was my beautiful aunt. I had lots of aunts. Some were silly, some were sweet. They all were smart. One had her own business. One was a nun. But Aunt Florence was my beautiful aunt. She had long blonde hair that swooped across her forehead like a movie star. She wasn't a blood relative. She was an in-law, an outlaw, my mother used to say. Married to my Uncle Ned, my father's brother. Aunt Florence didn't have any children, was always dressed up. You never saw Aunt Florence with her nylon stockings rolled down and knotted just below her knee. Aunt Florence never had a cloth diaper slung over one shoulder for a colicky baby. No, Aunt Florence always wore high heels and earrings and rings on her right hand. Rings with stones of blue and red and green and yellow, and it's from Aunt Florence that I learned the word topaz. The other aunts didn't always have their hair and lipstick in place. The other aunts didn't wear fancy jewelry. The other aunts, except for the one who had her own business and the one who was a nun, the other aunts always had a bunch of kids hanging off them, were always screaming at somebody to get down from there, always looked a little tired or worried. But Aunt Florence never looked tired or worried. Aunt Florence was always smiling, always beautiful. And I never knew until many years later how not having any children broke her heart. And she would happily have traded all her topaz for a colicky baby any day. But she did have the recipe for poppy seed swirls. It was her mother's specialty. But Aunt Florence didn't bake. And so she gave the recipe to my mother, wrote it out on an index card, that coffee-stained index card that has brought Aunt Florence into the kitchen with us that day we were making poppy seed swirls. My mother and I start to make the poppy seed filling, 2 cans of poppy seed, 1/2 cup of sugar, 1/4 cup of milk, heated until it's smooth enough to be able to spread. And while we work, my mother tells me how her mother, my grandmother, whom she called Mom, had her own poppy seed grinder, a little cast iron grinder. You put the poppy seeds in an opening at the top, turn the crank to grind the seeds that fall down into a little drawer at the bottom, put the seeds back in the top, grind again over and over, 3, maybe 4 times, turning tiny poppy seeds into infinitesimally small poppy seeds that Mom made into a paste with sugar and milk. Mom worked so hard, my mother says, but she never complained. Mom made Christmas Eve dinner every year for 28 people, 28 people, and she did it all on a coal stove. No temperature controls. You just had to know where the hot spots were, where the cold spots were, but nothing ever burned, my mother says. Mom moved those pots and pans around on top of that stovetop like a blackjack dealer in Las Vegas, and everything always came out warm and delicious right on time. Mom worked so hard, my mother repeats, and the kitchen door opens, and Mom walks in, her blue eyes twinkling. She tucks a stray strand of silver hair into the bun at the back of her neck and says, "You call this baking? I used to make 8, 9, 10 loaves of bread at one time, mix up the dough in a 5-gallon pot, and I baked them in a coal stove, no temperature controls. Now you have it so easy. Gas, oven, temperature controls, microwave, time delay feature on the dishwasher so it makes the whooshing noise while you're out of the house." I say to her, "Grandmother, wait a minute. First of all, my dishwasher is 17 years old. I do not have a time delay feature on my dishwasher. Second of all, you died in 1959. How do you know about microwaves and dishwashers?" She winks at me. We keep up. She sits down, folds her hands in her lap, hands that can rest now as they never could when she ran her own household. And I'm so glad Grandmother is right there in the kitchen with us so she can see how lovingly she is remembered. In my Alabama kitchen, the sunshine glints off the silver tinsel on our Christmas tree. There's a little tree about 4 feet tall, a little conifer, way at the back of my yard. It's exactly opposite the kitchen window, so you see it every time you look out that window. And we've made that into our Christmas tree, decorated it with strands of glass beads and orange and gold Christmas balls, silvery tinsel, a ridiculously large red velvet bow pinned to the very tip of the topmost branch that has flopped over from the weight of the bow. With that tree's perfect triangular shape and gaudy decorations, it looks just like a little 5-year-old girl at her tap dance recital, skirts sticking out over layers of petticoats, a big bow in her hair. And if it weren't for that heavy red Alabama clay holding it down, I think that tree could dance. The sun glinting off the tinsel makes us look, and looking at our Alabama tree reminds my mother of a tree they had when she was 14 years old back in 1935. It was called a cotton tree. You ever hear such a thing? A cotton tree. It was all the rage in the 1930s. You'd take a bare branch of a regular tree, not a fir tree, regular tree, bare branch, stick it in a bucket of gravel so it would stand up straight. Then you had to wrap every branch tightly with white cotton, not fabric cotton, first aid cotton. It was supposed to look like the tree was dusted with snow. My mother's sister, Julie, my Aunt Julie, had seen it advertised in the magazine, and she thought it would be so beautiful. But my mother said it took hours and hours and hours to do, and when they were finished, she said it looked like the tree was bandaged. And she confesses that when Julie wasn't watching, she would break off branches so she didn't have to wrap them. Oh, come on, we had fun doing it, Aunt Julie says as she pushes her way into the kitchen. Aunt Julie had fun doing anything. Aunt Julie had a big, funny laugh, and she'd always show up with homemade cookies or homemade fudge, or once she brought her famous homemade donuts that didn't quite get cooked inside, but she just told us they were cream-filled and we ate them. The poppy seed filling is ready to spread. We smooth it out onto our four rectangles of dough, then roll each rectangle into a tight log. My two split in the middle have thin poppy seed gravel oozing out everywhere. Mothers are perfect. They go in the oven. We have 35 minutes while they bake. My mother picks up a white cotton towel, starts to wipe down the counter. The towels came from my Uncle Frankie, who had a business distributing towels and table linens to the hotels and restaurants up and down the Pennsylvania Turnpike between Reading and the western edge of Philadelphia. And as soon as my mother picks up that towel and I think of Uncle Frankie, I hear the doorbell on the front door of that house back in Reading. It goes three times in quick succession, bing, 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 and I know who it is. It is Aunt Louise. Aunt Louise, whom we called Lulu, who was married to Uncle Frankie for 62 years. I answer the door. Lulu whooshes past me, talking a mile a minute the whole time. Is your mother here? Did she look at the book? Hey, Helen, what'd you think of that last promotion? Listen, can you fill in for me on Saturday? I gotta go to Scranton. I don't wanna miss the deadline. Lulu and Uncle Frankie began their 62 years together by running away to get married. It was hard times, no money for ceremony or fuss. And so Lulu borrowed a pale blue suit from a friend. Uncle Frankie borrowed a navy blue jacket from a buddy, and they ran off to be married by a justice of the peace. An ironic start to their turbulent years together. Lulu always said she was 17 years old when they eloped, but nobody knew how old she really was then. In fact, no one ever knew how old she ever was. She always lied about her age. She lied when she was younger to make herself older so she could start working before she was 16, and then she kept on lying to make herself younger as the years went on. When she finally did die at the age of 94, she left behind specific instructions that the age in her obituary was to be shown as 72. Her youngest sister, Vicky, who was in her mid-80s at the time, agreed to that, but the other sisters in their 80s and 90s protested that there was no possible way Lulu could be 15 to 20 years younger than the rest of them. And so Vicky gave in, and in the little card you got at the funeral home, her age was shown as 78. My mother said it was the only time she'd ever heard of anyone getting 6 years older after they died. Lulu also left behind instructions that she was to be buried in her wedding dress. Not the pale blue suit she'd borrowed all those years ago, but the white, lace, full-length wedding gown with the 5-foot train and sweetheart neckline she bought for herself when she was 81 years old. She said she couldn't afford a wedding dress when she was 17 or 15 or however old she was then, but she could afford one now. And so she walked into that bridal shop, bought herself that dress, and was buried in it, complete with a fingertip veil and rhinestone tiara. But the day she showed up in my kitchen, the day we were making poppy seed swirls, she was just wearing that dark green wool winter coat she always wore, trailing a cloud of forever amber perfume behind her. I hear feet stamping on the back steps. It's my dad, shaking the snow off his shoes before he comes inside, his ears pink, the cold clinging to his navy blue jacket. He comes in, says, what smells so good? Kisses my mother, tousles my hair, says, what do you know, schluggo? Then heads down the cellar steps to his workbench where he is making a stable for a nativity set for my mother, the Christmas of 1961. The stable was about 18 inches tall, bigger than they usually are. It had a peaked roof and a hayloft with real hay inside, a tiny ladder perfectly scaled leading up to it, a split rail fence all the way around. My father was making the stable, but that nativity scene was populated by a strange collection of characters, figurines that were mostly gifts to my mother from different people over the years. I mean, there was Mary and Joseph, of course, but there were shepherds. Lots and lots of shepherds. Shepherds of every possible size and shape and style. Some of the sheep were bigger than some of the camels that came from somewhere else. There was a cow herd. Someone had given my mother a cow herd, this little boy wearing what looked like lederhosen, leading this black and white cow that had a confused look on its face, like, what am I doing in this story? There were three wise men, but they were of different vintages. Two of the wise men were from the original set, but the third one, Balthazar, was a replacement. The first Balthazar having been decapitated in an unfortunate game of keep away. The replacement Balthazar was about 50% bigger than the other two. He had on a kind of flashy red velvet and gold robe, was wearing a sort of fez, made him look more like a Shriner than a King of the Orient. There was an angel hanging from a peg at the top of the peaked roof. She had on a long pink gown and kind of swoopy blonde hair. She sort of looked like Aunt Florence. It was a strange collection of characters gathered around that nativity scene, but no stranger than the strange collection of characters who had gathered in the kitchen of my imagination the day we were making poppy seed swirls. Characters of every size and shape and style, some matching, some not. In-laws, outlaws, real and remembered. That odd assortment of souls who populate our lives and our memories, who sit at our tables, who drink our coffee, who are part of holidays past, holidays present, any holiday yet to come, anytime we choose to invite them in. The timer dings, the poppy seed swirls are ready to come out. As I lift them onto a wire rack, I feel puffs of cool air on my cheek as the kitchen door in my mind slowly opens and shuts. And I know that they're leaving, all going away, until another holiday ritual or black and white photo or whiff of some familiar perfume calls them back. Just my 85-year-old mother and me there in that kitchen that was a wreck. Sink stacked high with bowls, beaters, baking sheets, spoons, spatulas. My mother says, oh, just use the time delay feature on the dishwasher. I say, Mother, I've told you 100 times I do not have a time delay feature on my dishwasher. She says, sure you do. It's the same one I had. Just leave everything there in the sink. We'll deal with it tomorrow. We make a fresh pot of coffee, take a plate of poppy seed swirls into the living room to sample, kick off our shoes, prop up our feet, and in the deepening December dusk, I remember why people bother to bake at holiday time. It's not the food, it's the fellowship.
You're listening to Food and Fellowship, a holiday special from WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. This is Food and Fellowship, a holiday special from WBHM. I'm Bobby Horton with storyteller Dolores Hydock.
One day I asked my mother who she wanted to meet when she got to heaven. I thought she'd say my dad, or maybe her parents, or maybe that fifth grade teacher she liked so much, the one who taught her how to crochet. But she didn't mention any of them, and she didn't hesitate. She answered right away, as if she had already given this some thought. She said, "I want to meet St. Anthony and St. Joseph." My mother had a whole roster of saints she called on for help, each with a particular area of expertise. St. Anne, for instance, patron saint of mothers, St. Martha, patron saint of home cooks, St. Jude, patron of hopeless cases. I said to her once, some of their duties kind of seem to overlap a little bit. I mean, what if you're a mother who's a hopeless case as a cook? Who do you go to then? She said, "Well, most of the saints are specialists, but St. Jude is my primary care saint, so I go to him first." But St. Jude had not made the top two of who she wanted to meet in heaven, just St. Anthony and St. Joseph. Well, St. Anthony is the patron saint of lost things. He is your go-to guy if you need help finding something you lost. That letter from the IRS, that undeposited endorsed check for $200, that one really good black leather glove from a pair that cost you $30, you can't find it, St. Anthony can. And so I figured at some point, Mother must have lost something really important, and St. Anthony helped her find it, and that's why he made the top two. But St. Joseph. So I asked her, why St. Joseph? "Well," she said, "I feel like St. Joseph always gets a raw deal. All the time, but especially at Christmas time." She said, "At Christmas time, everybody makes a big fuss about Mary and the baby. And of course they're important. Of course they're important. But Joseph was important too. Who do you think got him to Bethlehem? Who do you think checked the road conditions, made sure the donkey was ready to travel? But is anybody excited to see Joseph? No, they get all worked up. Here come the shepherds. Oh, they're so cute with the little sheep. Oh, here's the wise men with their fancy, expensive presents. There's the angels singing up in the sky. Everybody loves them. But Joseph, he's just the guy in the brown robe blending into the woodwork there in the back of the stable." "Christmas carols," she said. "Who are the Christmas carols about? Angels we have heard on high, while shepherds watch their flocks by night. We three kings of Orient are. What child is this? Even the town of Bethlehem has a Christmas carol. But Joseph, have you ever heard a Christmas carol about Joseph? Yeah, one, the cherry tree carol, and it makes him seem like a grumpy old man." "Christmas cards," she said. "If people are sending out cards, if they don't have snowmen and reindeer on the front, who do they have? Angels, wise men, shepherds. Madonna and child. Where's Joseph? Out in the back, parking the donkey." She said, "Nowadays, everybody wants to be famous." She said, "They sit there at their computers for hours, and they're flagging, or they're flogging, or they're bogging down. What are they doing? They're blogging, Mother. They're blogging. My mother did not have a computer. I don't want to get addicted to those chat rooms. But she read two newspapers a day. She made friends with the 13-year-old girl who lived next door. So she kept up. In fact, once she said to me, one of the cable channels has had a week-long marathon of I Love Lucy reruns. I've been LOL 24/7. So she knew some of the lingo. Blogging, she said, what kind of word is blogging? So they're sitting there and they're blogging and they're posting. Why? Because they have something important to say? Because they're going to make the world a better place? No, she said, it's because they want somebody to notice them. They want somebody to like them, to friend them, to trend them. She said, it's as if somebody's not paying attention to them every minute of the day, they don't exist. But there's Joseph. Never flashy. Never says, hey, what about me? He just shows up and does his job. He gets the family to Bethlehem. He gets them to Egypt. He gets them back to Nazareth. He was a carpenter. They say Jesus was a carpenter too. Where do you think he learned how to do it? I'll bet Joseph even taught him, measure twice, cut once. You know, she said, there are people, not a lot, but there are people who are just like Joseph, especially at Christmas time. She said, they're not the life of the party. They're not the ones in the sparkly sweaters leading the singing around the piano in the living room. No, she said, they're the ones in the kitchen washing the dishes so there's enough glasses to go around. They're the ones who have made three trips to the grocery store that week. The ones who've been up until midnight every night wrapping packages, including a little something for Miss Orphy, who lives down the street and probably won't have much this year. She said, they don't do it because it's going to make them famous. They don't do it because anybody's going to notice. They do it because that's just who they are. And just like Joseph, they make Christmas happen for other people more than any shepherd ever did. So yeah, she said, when I get to heaven, I want to meet St. Joseph. I want to thank him for the job he did, the example he set. He's supposed to be the patron saint of carpenters, but in my book, he's the patron saint of all those people who are never the star, never the center of attention. They just show up and do what has to be done, and somehow they manage to do it with love.
Thank you.
You know, most people know the story of Silent Night. The organ was broken in the church there, and the assistant pastor, Joseph Moore, actually, he was coming back from seeing a Christmas play on the night of December 23rd, and he looked down at the town of Ohrendorf, which was the little town in Austria where they lived and where his church was. And it was so peaceful and so quiet and such a still winter night that he thought about a poem that he had written 2 years before. Now, the organ was busted, and so he wanted to do something special. So the next morning, he asked his organist, Franz Gruber, if he could write a melody, a simple melody, to go with this poem that he handed to him and to be played on the guitar. Franz Gruber said he would try, and he did right well with it. And most people know that story. But I got to thinking, how did this song that we all know and love and associate with Christmas every year, how did that song get out of that little Austrian town and out into the world? Here's how it happened. The fellow that was going to repair the organ was a famous organ builder. His name was Karl Marocker. He came to repair the organ, which he did do. And so after he had finished with his repairs, he asked Franz Gruber, the organist, to get and check it out and make sure it was okay. Franz Gruber played Silent Night. The organ builder was so impressed. He said, "Wow, I love that. Can I have the words and music?" And he said, "Sure." And he gave him a copy. And so he went back to his little town in the Alps. The town is Kapfing, K-A-P-F-I-N-G. And when he got back, he knew two relatively famous singing families, the Rainers and the Strassers. So the Strassers actually went all through Northern Europe singing this song and made it kind of popular in Northern Europe. In fact, they performed the song for King Frederick William IV of Prussia one Christmas Eve, and he loved it so much he ordered his cathedral choir to sing it every Christmas for the rest of his life. So it's getting established in Northern Europe. Now, 1818 is when the song was written, and 20 years after its composition, the Rainers came to New York City and sang in German outside of the Alexander Hamilton Monument in New York City. People loved the tune. Later, by 1863, it had been translated into English, and it made its way into the Charles Hutchins Sunday School Journal, which was the bestseller of its day. Most people sang from that Sunday School Journal. And since that time, it's been translated into 300 languages.
Thank you.
Food and Fellowship, a holiday special from WBHM, was developed by Will Dahlberg with assistance and marketing from Audrey Atkins. The program was directed by Michael Crowell and engineered by Daryl McCullough. The house managers were Will Dahlberg and Rachel Lindley, and the general manager for WBHM is Scott Hanley. Special thanks to the staff of the Alice Stevens Center at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and of course, the members of WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. I'm Bobby Horton.
And I'm Dolores Hydock.
Wishing you and your family all the best this holiday season.